Bruce Hampton, Time is Free, Club 121, and the year was 1989. And our guest is Brock Henderson. How you doing? Thanks for bringing that in, by the way.
Yeah, let's thank Jamie Shoemaker for making that back when tapes were how you got stuff off the board. Little cassette tapes.
Cassette tapes. So that's a board tape on cassette from 121 in Knoxville. So Chuck Burnley must have booked this show.
Totally Chuck Burnley.
And you were there.
Yes, yes, yeah. It started when I was 15.
Brock Henderson, if you just joined us, is our guest on this evening's Improvisations. He is the leader of the Brockerfellers, but he also plays with Lonesome Coatees, Hector Kirko, Ian Thomas, Same As It Ever Was. You're very likely to see him if you go see music. So if you don't see him, you're not seeing enough music. Is that fair?
Yeah.
And we're here basically to talk about the music of Colonel Bruce Hampton and various appendage bands with ever-changing names. Do you remember which version of the band this was from 89?
I think it was the Aquarium Rescue Unit at that point.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think he was calling it Aquarium Rescue Unit pretty much the whole time that I knew of that group.
So this was 1989, Bruce Hampton and the Aquarium Rescue Unit. I guess the first time I ever saw him, he was with the Arkansas Travelers came after.
It might be. I mean, like I said, when I first saw Bruce Hampton, I was 15. And it was Bo Ratliff, who has influenced all kinds of people in Knoxville, turning them on to Frank Zappa and other music. He insisted that we all go down and check out the show at Planet Earth. And like I said, I was 15. And maybe Planet Earth was a little more lenient, or I just hung out with the right people. But so I got to start going in there when I was 15 and hanging out with Bruce Hampton and started bringing different bands. And then I guess it was about 87 when it started, you know, being O'Teal and Jeff Sipe and the regular, you know, what we know as the Aquarium Rescue Unit, the legendary Aquarium Rescue Unit band.
What was your impression the very first show? So Bo Ratliff says, you got to see this. I like it when people tell me that. You got to see this. And they're like missionaries because they're usually onto something. What was your first impression when you walked in and saw the band?
I was blown away. It was kind of like I just started getting into Frank Zappa, and it was kind of like I didn't know it then because I didn't know the history of Zappa at the time. There was no internet to easily research this stuff. But as I find out later in the years, it was like we basically had our own Garrick Theater is what it was like. It was just it was very experimental. The early shows were very experimental and just, I mean, you didn't know what you were going to get. It was vaudeville meets virtuosic, you know. It was a playground.
Now, was the first time you saw him, this is pre-Jimmy Herring or post-Jimmy
Herring?
Yeah,
pre-Jimmy Herring, and I wish I could remember the name of the guy that played guitar with him.
Davey?
Well, I saw a show with Davey Williams, and did you see that show?
I saw that show. It was.
You might have even done the show with him.
I think I did.
Yeah. He hopped from the back of the room in one of those little plastic chairs all the way from the back of the room. This little guy looked like he belonged in Devo. Then when he got to the front of the stage, he hopped up on the stage, and then he picked up a Steinberger guitar with no headstock, you know, with a whammy bar that goes all the way back. And he played the thing with a tape measure, and then he would put like a guitar slide under the strings and bounce it. He made the sound like the old school Battlestar Galactica Cylons. The roll, wow, the roll, wow. Just the weirdest sounds ever. And, you know, later as I got to know Bruce Moore, like, who the heck was that guy? He told me he's Davey Williams. He's got a band called Curlew. And I went and checked out all those bands because I talked to Bruce on and off when I was in the circus. I was in the Ringling Brothers and Barney Buddy Circus and had a job playing music, getting paid enough before MP3s, and went to New York City and spent everything I made at every CD store I could. So I got about three or four of that guy's stuff. But I mean, just countless people that he surrounded himself with, just these amazing musicians. But I guess the Jimmy Herring band, that Jimmy Herring started coming around probably around 88, 89, I guess.
Yeah. Did you ever talk to Bruce Hampton about his guitar players in particular? Or did you ever say, like, you know, how did you like the Davey Williams era or things like that? Because I got to talk to Bruce a few times, but I never got to really ask him all the questions I wanted to ask him.
Well, I think Davey just was a one-time thing, you know, like, this is the guy I'm coming up with this week. I mean, by the time, like I said, around 88, it was regularly the ARU with Jimmy Herring and then Matt Mundy playing the mandolin. start getting into the early 90s, and Jeff Mosier came around, which the banjo player, which if anybody's not checked out much about Bruce Hampton and they want to know more, Google or YouTube Jeff Mosier, Bruce Hampton, because Jeff Mosier was very, very close with Bruce and did an amazing interview with him. It's about an hour long, and you can get a really good idea of what Bruce, just what it's like to have a conversation with Bruce Hampton.
Do you have a favorite Hampton era?
My heart lies in the, you know, 87, 88, mind-blowing experience of seeing them down at Planet Earth. You know, the third floor of the Planet Earth was Chuck Burnley's apartment / green room. And, I mean, 15-year-old kid, I'm going up and hanging up in the green room with the band, and they treated me like just a person and completely took me under their wing. And I think that countless musicians can say the same thing. They were just very nice. They taught me that, you know, these guys are playing A-level playing, and they're completely humble and talking to you just like you're a person. And
you were a person, right?
I was turning into a person. I was actually, you know, I was 15, so I was just figuring everything out. And it was really relieving because I was getting really serious finally with music by the time I was 16. And I was starting to get an inkling, an idea that this was something I really wanted to do. Bruce would always say, don't do it unless you have to. Don't do it unless you have to. But I was starting to really listen to, like, John McLaughlin, and I was turned on to Zappa, which means you're talking about a lot of different guitar players and musicians. So I was really getting into all that, but it was cool to see, because Bruce's approach kind of let you realize that it was okay to be serious about music, but you didn't have to be so serious. And that's kind of what made it work and made it entertaining, was it brought it down to the level where everyone could enjoy it, because you have these incredible virtuosic musicians playing this incredible stuff, but he was kind of like the medium that brought it back down to earth to where it was, you know, accessible to everybody and entertaining. Otherwise, it was just another Return to Forever or Chick Corea band kind of thing would have happened, because they were just so amazing.
Well, that was my feeling when I first started to go see them. And for me, it was Chuck Burnley who was very insistent that I not miss the show, and mentioned it several times and almost threatened me, I believe. I knew if he had that kind of zeal about it, there was something there. And I went, and I mean, I knew about the Hampton Grease Band, you know, and I remember that record was kind of weird. I didn't like it that much, but I liked what they were going for. And then I came in and I was floored, because it was all that stuff you said. It was not just a collection of outstanding musicians, but it was a collection of outstanding musicians working towards one vision of one man, that a vision I've never seen before or since. You know, like, his vision was really, really unique. You can say, yeah, he listened to Zappa, or he listened to soul music, or he listened to jazz, but it was really him. I mean, everything just felt like him.
Yeah, he was about capturing the now. I don't want to paraphrase him incorrectly. He was something about the future is a crux, so then there could be no now. It's like, he's very, very into the moment. He was very into you being yourself, finding your own voice. Zappa was good at that too. Of course, Zappa wrote a lot and composed a lot more music than Bruce did, but Bruce thing was more improvisatory, kind of, you know, the canvas was the stage. In fact, I remember, I think the second album they had, the record label was a little more, let's produce-y with it. And I don't know that they were as happy with that one as much as they were the first one, because the first one was like live shows.
Yep.
And they were a live band, and that's where the magic lied with that band. And the earlier years, like, you know, they were doing a lot more risky stuff. They still did risky stuff once they started catching on, but as the Grateful, because, you know, Jerry Garcia was still around, so all the Deadheads would start coming to the show, and then they'd tell five other people, and then the next thing you know, they're all there. Whether they're there just for the music or just so they could do drugs and freak out, and at the freak out parts, I don't know, or both. But you would, you know, you'd look around the room, and on once, you know, intermix, you would see, not labeling people, but hippies or, you know, Grateful Dead fans, and you'd see jazz musicians and jazz fans, and it was just a crossbreed of all kinds of stuff. I kind of think that Bruce Hampton really did start the heartbeat for the jam band scene. I mean, they started doing the Horde Festival, and all the bands like Widespread Panic and Fish and those bands, that Blues Traveler, they had more record sales, and so people knew who they were, and so they were the end of the thing, and Bruce would be closer to the front of it. But everyone on the tour, they knew that the Aquarium Rescue Unit, that was the band.
Well, we saw the turnout for his his birthday party, his final show in Atlanta, that was a really wide variety of musicians and personalities from many different backgrounds. Peter Buck and Mike Mills from REM, which were not a band that musically was very simpatico with Bruce, but boy, they loved him, and fellow Georgians. And then even Jake Peavy, the pitcher for the San Francisco Giants, was there. I mean, it was just...
Oh, Bruce knew some baseball. He loved some baseball. I remember when he first started doing those shows, he would come on stage with baseball cleats and whatever those baseball pants that come up to, you know, just below your knees.
Yeah.
And a baseball jersey. Speaking of which, just before I forget, we owe a lot to Chuck Burnley. The Planet Earth, the stuff that happened at Planet Earth, we were all blessed to get to witness that.
Yeah.
And we were very blessed to have Chuck Burnley. And he was amazing and did a lot for just bringing some amazing music to Knoxville. But were you at the show where Bruce picked Chuck up over the top of his head and body slammed him on the stage? Because he also was a wrestling manager.
Yes, and I wasn't at that show. I mean, I heard about it. It was one of those that I think I was out of town. But, I mean, if you missed any Bruce Hampton show in Knoxville, there was a unique happening that you missed that show. You know, like, that's why it was so fun to go back over and over and over, which I almost do with nobody, you know. Like a lot of bands you go see and you go, I got it. I enjoyed it, you know. That was really good. But with Hampton, you never knew what was going to happen. There may be a completely different musician in the band that night that I didn't know this guy was in the band. Or I didn't see Chuck Burnley get body slammed.
He was so good with banter, too, and spontaneous stuff. Like, you know, if you'd never seen him, this is your first time seeing him. Because I remember the first time he said it, I was confused, but he'd say, we can move your furniture, and he'd give out a fake phone number, and then he'd say it again, and the next time the phone number was completely different, you know, and then you finally go, oh, okay, yeah, he's just, this is all a, you know, he got me, he's got me hooked in the mouth. But yeah, he was very good on the mic with
just, spontaneous.
Yeah, and I feel sorry for those kids if they were on drugs.
Yeah, well, I have to say, it was kind of weird because, you know, the first few times he came to Knoxville, there were no dancing hippie types, right? I like dancing hippie types. I got nothing against them at all. But but they weren't there, and all of a sudden, you know, I just remember a couple of years later, just where did they come from? I mean, it was great to see him have a huge crowd.
Yeah, it definitely changed the show. But it was still a good show, but it
oh, yeah.
Yeah, it seemed like when that happened, the bluegrass stuff started coming in more. The two-beat stuff. And then they would just take it then out into a totally another direction.
Well, he pulled them in with that, or the, maybe like almost like an Allman Brothers kind of thing. But even if it started there, you know, it would end somewhere else. Well, let's listen to some more of this music. What's the next one?
Let's try the Quenius Thoth. We'll be right back.
Well, that was wonderful. That was absolutely wonderful. Quinius Thoth, or Quinius Thoth, or Thoth. Colonel Bruce Hampton, the Aquarium Rescue Unit. Our guest is Brock Henderson, guitar player for the Brockerfellers. He also plays with the Lonesome Coyotes, Hector Kirko, Ian Thomas. You were in Ringling Brothers.
Yeah, thanks to your compatriot,
Mr. Dave Nichols. Yeah, well, it's all related. It's all interconnected. And we're talking about Bruce Hampton. I always felt like that might have been the greatest show on earth in a lot of ways, because when they were at their best, I felt like I got it all. I got it all. I got entertained. I got enlightened. I got joy. I got inspiration. I got humbled. You know, I mean,
you can't say it in one word.
No, it's three rings at least.
Yeah, you can't say it in one word.
Did he ever say anything to you? Like, I know you got a lot of time to spend getting to know him and the musicians over the years, and you got to play with him some. Is there anything he ever told you or said to you that really was a resonant type of?
Well, he used to always tell me, "Don't do it unless you have to," in regards to playing music, meaning doing it like they were doing it. You know, oh, I want to be just like you guys. You know, I was 15 when I first met him, he would just, through the years, he's like, "Don't do it unless you have to do it." And then finally he's like, "Oh, you went ahead and did it."
And did you have to do it?
Yeah, I did. Yeah, I mean, I didn't have to. There's a lot of things I could have done, but it's in my heart. And I think that Bruce Hampton has a lot to do with that. And I know countless musicians, and some of them with huge careers and big names, you know, Fish, Widespread Panic, several of these musicians will say that Bruce influenced them, I think, in a major way. Now, I don't know if they, you know, I'm sure Fish was doing their thing before maybe they crossed paths with Bruce, but just seeing Bruce Hampton do what he did when I was 15 and through the different bands, and I was blessed to be a part of the Planet Earth shows, just to see that stuff, that it was okay to be very serious about your instrument. At the same time, you could be on stage and remember vaudeville and entertaining people and entertaining yourself. I mean, just, you know, and if you're having a good time, generally, for the most part, you know, audiences that are music lovers will enjoy it too. Can't speak for the discotheques, but, you know, for the most part, people are going to perceive that you're entertaining it. And so I learned a lot of stuff from just watching him without him even having to say anything.
Transmission. It really is. And in a way, it kind of reminds me of Sun Ra or Thelonious Monk or NRBQ, whereas all those people had superior, you know, ability on their instruments or on their writing in many cases. But they seem to be having as much fun or more fun than anybody.
Yeah.
I mean, Thelonious Monk used to get up and, you know, dance on the stage or go in the kitchen and grab something to eat and come back and eat on the stage and just sit there and enjoy himself. As a guitar player, what did you pick up by watching Hampton and his group all those years?
Well, that last track that we played, I just wanted to, since we didn't get to say anything about it, that's Bruce Hampton's vocabulary on an instrument. And it took me a while to get used to his vocabulary on an instrument because it sounds very out. But he definitely, if you hear him time and time again, you realize, wow, this is his vocabulary. And I think that was one thing that I learned a lot from him that he brought out of other players was that you need to have your own vocabulary. I remember him used to always talking about, don't play in the dots, you know, don't play in the boxes, you know. I mean, and we're talking too, this was the end of the 80s when I met him. So everybody was trying to be Steve Vai and Eddie Van Halen. And some people were doing really good at it. It's just like, hey, who are you going to buy? Eddie Van Halen's record or the guy? It sounds like Eddie Van Halen. And I witnessed him, you know, Jimmy Herring to me is one of the most phenomenal guitar players on the planet. And he's one of the most extremely beautiful human beings. I mean, the guy's just, he's just so sweet and loving. And I watched Bruce, you know, work on him because, I mean, he could play anybody's stuff. I mean, Stevie Ray Vaughan, Eric Johnson, you name it. And there were some times where I, you know, because I got the luxury of being backstage, you know, I heard him like saying, you know, if I wanted Steve Morse, I'd hired Steve Morse. Part of it was probably in jest and joke, but it was just, I think he was very, very big into express yourself and be in the moment. I mean, it was a live music thing, you know, improvisation and in the moment, being in the now. I don't think it was meant to ever be a Steely Dan, like, you know, really well overly produced kind of thing. And, you know, my first band, Free Formula, we basically called it Free Form Yilla because the free form aspect, and there were four of us, so we spelt it silly. But, you know, we were definitely all here. They were our heroes. So we were just trying to figure out how can we take, like, King Crimson and Yes and the music we like and try to do what they do. And so basically we had, you know, songs that had, like, about 8 or 9 good song ideas that were just duct taped together. And the rest was just, like, chaos in between.
Through the years, Hampton definitely went through lots of changes, lots of different musicians. Did you see any of the later gigs in the last year or two?
Yes, yeah, actually, I saw his last gig he did in Knoxville down at Barley's. I saw him on my break because I was playing down the street, so I didn't actually get to see the show, but I got to see him. I've been going down there and seeing him, like, you know, he'll come every 3 or 4 months, and I've been lucky enough to catch a couple of them. One time he even let me get up there and play the pedal steel with him, and he'd asked me to play it with him next time he came to Knoxville, but, you know.
And if you don't know what the story is, so it's like they were having a 70th birthday party at the Fox Theater and all these different people there, some of we mentioned earlier. And during the encore, he kind of went down and he never got back up. What do you view about, what's your feelings on about how it all ended? I mean, did it freak you out or was there something poetic about
it? My first thought exactly was what you said, that that's just poetic and maybe that's just a way to make yourself feel better about it. But at the same time, it's like, how perfect. On your birthday, 4th encore in front of everybody. I mean, I can't say that he planned or didn't. I don't know. I've heard different stories from different people. That's probably for them to say and not for me. I know that it helps make it a little bit easier that it happened like that, I think, for if you knew him and loved him or if you're a fan of his. Like you were saying earlier, when you start to think about someone's life later and then it all starts to come together. And I've been thinking about it more, obviously, and preparing for this interview to talk to you. And it's just, there's the 7 steps to Kevin Bacon, for me, literally. And I was talking to Chad Melton, who also is very affected by Bruce Hampton, drummer about town, wonderful drummer. we agreed the three steps to Kevin Bacon, or the three steps to Bruce Hampton, it only takes three steps. Everyone I know in my life or something related to my life, I can actually go three steps. And he was kind of like the sun, just everyone orbiting around him. If you're lucky enough, I feel blessed that I got to know him and spend as much time with him. And he didn't even have to say anything. Although he could. He could guess your birthday. He could do all kinds of amazing things. He was like a medium. And he channeled this energy. And it just, if you were lucky enough to be around it, it just, whatever you were good at doing, you did it 20 times better when he was around. That's the kind of person he was. And him not even being around and me thinking about him over the past couple of days when you asked me to do this, it just, there were hours going by that I'd sat here and babbled an interview out that I wish that you had been recording at the moment. That's how much he just inspires you to go in tangents in the moment, in the now.
That's how everybody feels about him that knew him. I've never heard anybody say anything really negative about him. Not that I've asked, but I mean, just the general view from musicians and fans that people have met him, it's all that he's just sort of inspires people wherever he goes. You know, I'm talking about him in the present tense because in a sense, I feel that the fact that he's influenced so many people and connected so many people, he still lives, right? In my view, he's still around. He's just not physically available. But just all the musicians that talked about him, you know, leading up to his birthday and then since he passed away, I mean, they all just talk about, you know, like, what an incredible spirit, and that I feel that he gave a lot of musicians a vehicle to become themselves where they might not even have done that had they been playing their own music.
Yeah, he kind of gave you permission, a license to say that it's okay to, you know, be yourself.
I can see situations where I've talked to people that would be like, you know, I was playing such and such a gig and then I was doing this kind of thing and, you know, it was all right. I wasn't that happy. And then, you know, I'm playing with Hampton and all of a sudden I'm doing everything I've always wanted to do. I was being everything I always wanted a musician to be. One guy can do that? And they're like, yes. You know, two, but it takes two to tango. But, you know, playing in Hampton's band gave a vehicle to all these people to be their most creative. That's how I felt. Because I would see different people in his band do other things before and say, oh, that's great. You know, but it seems like after Hampton, before and after Hampton, their vocabulary was just a bit more open or more creative. I don't know. Maybe that's a projection of some sort.
No, I think you're right. Like I said, I don't think I would be doing what I'm doing today if I hadn't met Bruce Hampton at age 15. I probably would have played guitar, but I think I would have, without that teaching, I think I would have taken the music so serious, because I'm a pretty serious person at times, and I'm also have a really comical side, but with the music, you know, I was just taking it so serious, and you have to get to a certain level to be able to get hired and play, and you know, because you have to get hired if you're going to play. You can't just, you know, go down and play shows to nobody. But he kind of balanced it out, and his influence was so strong that it I think it really has helped me. I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing if it weren't for Bruce Hampton. I know that, and I think what we were talking about, him being in the present and the now, it's like the more and more I'm thinking about it, I'm realizing, wow, how much this guy affected me. I mean, I always knew he did, but having to think about him and that he's not here now, I'm realizing how much he is here. Like you said, it's like he really, and I think he's done that for so many people. And I think that the more that people can share their stories about Bruce Hampton, and people can know about that and see the connections, eventually they'll put books out and it'll be like the history of, like, you know, the Miles Davis quintets and all that stuff. It's a little bit different style of music, but still, it's like the rhythm sections that he put together, their Crime Rescue Unit is going to stand the test of time of being one of the most incredible rhythm sections that's ever been on the planet. And Bruce is at the center of all that stuff. And I think there'll be a lot of history that people will see the branches that have branched off because of the influence of one person, Colonel Bruce Hampton.
I guess he had to do it. Brock Henderson, thanks for talking to us here on Improvisation.
Thanks for having me.